Imagine willingly putting your head into an iron collar that, well, you know is absolutely going to crush your ribs, like snap your spine and fundamentally rewrite your entire biology, and doing all of that just to win a philosophical
I
debate.
mean, yeah, it sounds completely irrational.
Right. But today we are taking a deep dive into this really fascinating stack of chronicles from the lands of Merari, and they kind of prove that sometimes the most irrational act is literally the only way to save a society.
Yeah, exactly. And this isn't just, some standard fantasy adventure we're looking at. It's really a masterclass in the erasure of history.
Oh, absolutely. The anatomy of prejudice and what happens when an entire civilization just completely forgets its own origins.
Because honestly, the most dangerous thing an empire can do is forget where it came from. When a society loses its history, it becomes just incredibly vulnerable to manipulation.
So true.
And that is exactly what we see happening in the Winter Court, which is this really harsh, unforgiving, and deeply magical territory ruled by a fey aristocrat named Lord December.
Right, so picture this frozen, desolate landscape. It's a place where survival is already super difficult, but now something absolutely terrifying is happening. Prime age adults are just vanishing.
Poof, gone.
Yeah, they disappear at dusk. There's no struggle, there's no blood in the snow, no footprints leading away. But, and this is the really eerie part, their horses always return to town completely unharmed.
Which is so weird, right? It's this very specific, almost surgical kind of terror. And our sources for this deep dive follow two really incredible figures who are trying to unravel it.
Let's get into them.
Yeah. So the first is Knight Redmayne. She is this fiercely capable warrior from House May, but she's an outsider in the Winter Court. She isn't fey. She actually carries giant blood in her veins.
Right, specifically Fomorian and Jotun lineages, which
Yes.
is a huge detail for you to keep in mind. Having giant blood means she doesn't perceive the world the way the Fae do at all.
Exactly. I mean, fey magic is all about bending light, right? Creating illusions, basically playing tricks with your mind.
Yeah. But giant blood is grounded. It's tied to the earth, to gravity, to raw physical reality. She sees right through the shimmering mirages that trick literally everyone else.
Precisely. She relies entirely on the physical truth of the world. And the second figure we're tracking is Thomas, the enigmatic Lord Explorer,
The best of the best.
arguably the greatest tracker and survivalist in the whole land. But there is a massive problem here. As our chronicle opens, Thomas has already vanished into those wintry woods trying to solve these exact disappearances.
So he's the expert and he's already gone,
Yep.
which sets the stakes so high. You've probably been in a situation where two sides are bitterly fighting, completely convinced the other is evil. But what if the entire conflict is based on a forgotten lie? Okay, so let's unpack this. Redmayne arrives in the town of Lunefeld to pick up Thomas's trail.
And the town is just a mess, right?
Oh, completely. It's snow-choked and absolutely paralyzed by fear. So she sits down with the town leader, Hedman Jenrik Altstrom, and he lays out the pattern of these kidnappings.
Which is a really disturbing pattern.
Very. There are no ransom notes. The attackers leave the children entirely alone. They leave the elderly alone. They are exclusively harvesting strong, capable, fey adults.
And Redmayne, being the tactician she is, recognizes the reality of this immediately. If they are only taking fey adults, she has a big problem.
Right, because of how she looks.
Exactly. She has this bright, fiery red hair and the unmistakable complexion of her giant bloodline. She stands out like a sore thumb.
So if she wants to find out what's happening to these people and to Thomas, she basically needs to become the target.
Yeah, she goes into an inn, literally takes soot from the fireplace, and rubs it into her bright red hair to darken it.
Just brilliant improvised camouflage.
Right. Then she finds this pale lotion and covers her skin, essentially masking her giant heritage to look like a pale local fey warrior.
She turns herself into living bait.
She's just stepping out into the open, practically inviting whatever invisible force is out there to come take her.
Wait, okay, hold on. I'm looking at this from a tactical perspective, and I have to say, this sounds like a terrible plan.
How so?
I mean, Thomas is the best tracker alive, and he just disappeared out there. Redmayne is operating without backup, without a wire, just walking into a freezing forest alone to face something that already beat the absolute expert. How is that not just tactical suicide?
Well, it absolutely looks like suicide if you assume she's going to fight them on their terms. But Redmayne isn't relying on brute force here.
Even though she carries that massive iron sword, right, Morrigan.
Yeah, she has the giant sword, but she's relying on her giant biology first. Like we mentioned, fey survival in the Winter Court relies heavily on visual glamours. The fae trick the eye.
Okay, yeah.
So whatever's hunting them is likely using those exact same visual tricks.
So she just, what, turns off her eyes?
Kind of, yeah. She completely ignores what she sees. As she walks into the woods, the trees are casting these impossible shadows. Fake faces are appearing in the bark. Phantom lights are dancing in her periphery.
Which would totally freak out a normal person.
A fae warrior would be completely disoriented by that. But Redmayne just ignores it all. She focuses entirely on the physics of the forest. The crunch of snow compressing under a heavy paw.
Oh, wow.
The subtle snapping of a frozen branch. She uses her grounded nature to track the physical weight of the threat, cutting right through all that magical static.
And it works almost too well, honestly. It pulls her directly into the heart of the forest's secret. So she's moving through the trees, right? Dodging literal piles of heavy snow that are being dropped from the canopy to trap her.
It's basically a gauntlet.
Yeah, and she's ignoring these creepy, disembodied voices that are mimicking the townspeople. And finally, she tracks the physical sound to a massive tree-climbing wolf.
But of course, it doesn't stay a wolf.
No. Right in front of her, it shifts into this fierce, battle-scarred woman named Ertzabet.
And this is where the curtain really gets pulled back on the whole mystery. Ertzabet, along with another snow woman named Sveda, corners Redmayne. But they don't just attack her.
Right, they want to show her something.
Exactly. They use this ancient blood magic sigil to show Redmayne the truth of what's actually happening in the woods.
The vanishing fae aren't dead.
No, they're not. They're being abducted by Ertzabet's people, which is this ancient, forgotten tribe of wolf shifters that are slowly dying out.
And they're desperate.
So desperate. What? The winters have grown way too harsh. Their numbers are too few. And the elders of this wolf tribe have concocted a deeply, deeply horrific survival strategy.
The iron collars.
Yes, the iron collars. The wolves are taking these captured fae adults and physically bolting heavy iron collars around their necks.
We really need to explain the mechanics of this because it's not just a physical restraint, right? Like, iron is basically radioactive to fae creatures.
That's actually a perfect way to put it. Cold iron grounds magic. It literally burns away the ethereal, magical nature of the fae.
Ouch.
So when this collar is locked onto them, the iron toxicity acts as this sort of biological panic button. To survive the burning of their magical essence, the fae body undergoes a violent forced mutation.
It strips away their fae form.
Yes, and forcibly turns them into wolves. The elders are literally mutating their enemies to replenish their own dwindling pack.
It is just a horrifying, localized, forced evolution. And the blood magic sigil shows Redmayne exactly how Thomas encountered this.
Right. We get to see what happened to him.
And the visual we get from this memory is stunning. Thomas is running for his life from a pack of these wolves across a massive frozen lake. The ice is just cracking under the weight of the pack.
So intense.
Thomas brilliantly throws a rope attached to a grapple hook, catches a sturdy tree on the far shore, and uses his momentum to slide across the thinning ice to safety.
Such a classic Lord Explorer move.
Totally. And the wolves behind him lose their footing and completely crash through the ice into the freezing black water.
So he outsmarts them perfectly. He's safe on the shoreline. He is officially won.
But then here is where it gets really interesting. He does the unthinkable. He secures the rope around his waist, turns around, and dives straight back into the freezing water to save the very wolves that were just trying to tear his throat out.
Which makes no sense to them.
It's like inheriting a lifeboat and immediately tossing it to the pirates who just sank your ship. Why do it? I mean, why risk freezing to death for your executioners?
Well, because Thomas operates on a totally different psychological and philosophical level than the rest of the Winter Court. He understands that true power isn't about dominion or destruction. It's about giving life.
Wow.
Yeah, as he hauls these freezing, drowning wolves out of the water, he looks at them and his message is incredibly simple. He just says, "You are not my enemy."
And that completely breaks the wolves' brains.
It really does. I mean, they are a dying culture, completely entrenched in this survival of the fittest, killer be killed mindset. Compassion just doesn't compute for them.
It goes against everything they know.
It violates the very laws of nature as they understand them.
So because his compassion completely breaks their understanding of how the world works, they don't just kill him on the shoreline. They beat him, they collar him, and they drag him back.
And when Ertzabet finishes showing this memory to Redmayne, it sets up the exact same dynamic.
Right.
They don't just kill Redmayne. They need to prove their worldview is right. So they drag her deep into their ruined, hidden city, of Namenwolf.
They take her right to the center of the city, to this grand, decaying cathedral known as the Circle of the Fallen. This is where the elders of the wolf tribe hold court.
And Redmayne, surrounded by these massive, hostile wolves, actually tries to debate them.
She does. She tells them point blank, look, I've fought the Fae for centuries. You cannot win a war of attrition this way. Antagonizing Lord December's armies by stealing their people will only lead to your absolute extinction.
But the elders totally dismiss her. They believe they have the mandate of heaven, so to speak.
Right, because of their goddess.
Exactly. They revere Ceridwen, the goddess of change and rebirth. They really believe they are the true children of the winter, and the Fae are just these unnatural usurpers.
So Redmayne stops talking and gives them a physical demonstration of theology. She takes her massive iron sword, Morrigan, which, crucially, is consecrated to that exact same goddess, Ceridwen.
This is such a great moment.
It's amazing. Redmayne declares that if her strike leaves no mark on the temple floor, the elders are right. But if the stone breaks, their kidnappings are a blasphemy against their own goddess.
And she just brings the sword down on the sacred crescent moonstone right in the center of the floor.
And the granite completely splits in two. The blade sinks deep into the foundation of the cathedral. She physically proves them wrong in front of the entire pack.
She really does.
And this is where my jaw just dropped. She wins the moral argument. The pack is stunned. She has a giant, heavy iron sword in her hands. She is a giant blooded knight.
She's highly capable.
She could easily start swinging and fight her way out of that cathedral right then and there. But instead, she voluntarily strips off her armor. She drops her weapons and she submits to the iron collar.
It's wild.
I mean, why on earth would you subject yourself to that torture when you've already won the debate?
Because Redmayne realizes a really profound sociological truth in that exact moment. Force will not change their mind.
Oh, interesting.
Think about it. If she fights her way out, even if she kills the elders, she just proves that she is physically stronger. And what does that do? It validates their entire survivalist might makes right worldview.
Oh, wow. Yeah, if she beats them up, she's just the bigger alpha wolf.
Exactly. She realizes that to save them and to save the captured Fae, she has to dismantle their toxic culture from the inside. And you cannot change a culture if you are an outsider imposing your will. You have to become one of them.
But the Chronicles describe this transformation process, and it is not like some magical sparkle. It is sheer biological agony.
It is harrowing. Yeah. The text details the wet snapping of her bones as they forcefully realign.
Oh, gross.
Yeah, her spine arches, her ribs crush inward as her chest cavity rapidly reshapes to accommodate a quadrupedal form.
Just terrible.
The pain is absolutely blinding. And because she's losing her giant blood human form, her sensory perception of the world violently shifts. The vibrant colors of the cathedral literally bleed out of her vision, fading into these stark grays, whites, and pale reds.
But she endures it. And she doesn't just become a wolf. She deliberately allows herself to become an Omega Wolf, which is the absolute lowest, most submissive rank in their entire pack hierarchy.
Which is such a brilliant insurgency tactic.
Mm-hmm.
Real wolf packs, or at least the mythological structure these wolves follow, rely on the alpha to dictate reality.
Right.
By becoming the Omega, Redmayne intends to prove that true civilization isn't about the strong dominating the weak. It's about the strong protecting the weak.
Yes.
She basically intends to rot their bullying hierarchy from the very bottom up.
You know, an unbelievable sacrifice. But here's the thing. To change a society from within, you have to understand the true foundation of that society. A foundation that, well, it turns out even these wolf elders have completely forgotten.
And that leads us to the best discovery in the whole story.
Yes, the glowing moss-covered dwarven tunnels deep beneath the ruined city.
Right. So Redmayne, now in her Omega Wolf form, reunites with Thomas, who is also still trapped in a wolf form. And they're joined by Ertzibet, the snow woman who originally captured Redmayne.
Who is now having some serious doubts, right?
Exactly. Ertzibet is starting to seriously question her elder's dogma. So the three of them explore these ancient, forgotten catacombs beneath Abnemenwolf. And what they find painted on the cavern walls changes the entire political reality of the Winter Court.
The murals. The giant ancient murals illuminated by the cave moss. They show that the wolves and the Fae didn't actually always hate each other.
Not at all.
In fact, the murals depict the very first Lord of December, the ancient ancestor of the Fae ruler currently trying to wipe out the wolves. And he is standing hand in hand, deeply in love with a wolf woman.
It's beautiful. The murals show them being united, blessed by the goddess Ceridwen herself.
It is the ultimate historical revelation. The entire aristocratic structure of the Winter Court, the lands of December, were actually born out of the love and union between these two warring factions.
It really reframes everything.
So what does this all mean? It's like finding a forgotten family album hidden in the attic that proves two warring mob families are actually first cousins. I mean, why did they forget?
Well, this is where the Chronicles transition from just a fun fantasy story into a profound commentary on historical amnesia.
Okay, let's get into that.
Prejudice and isolation breed forgetting. Over the generations, the Fey ancestors of Lord December likely hid their wild wolf blood origins. They wanted to maintain political power and appear, you know, pure among the other high Fey houses.
Oh, so they just erased their own history to fit in.
Exactly. They sanitized their past for political convenience. Meanwhile, the wolves, feeling abandoned and pushed to the freezing fringes of the territory, let their bitterness and trauma completely overwrite their history.
They convinced themselves the Fey were always the enemy.
Right. It really highlights how easily foundational truths, the actual roots of our civilization, are erased by a combination of elite pride and marginalized fear.
And armed with this explosive truth of their shared bloodline, Redemain and Thomas realize that this current war isn't just a tragic misunderstanding born of time, it's actually a trap.
Yes. They realize the conflict was engineered by something far older and far more sinister than the Wolf Elders or the current Lord December.
Which catapults us to the spectacular aftermath of this deep dive. Let's jump forward a bit. Through a series of really intense magical and physical confrontations, Redemain and Thomas manage to break the cycle.
They get their collars off.
Yep, they're back in their human forms. And they actually manage to free all of the mutated Fey captives, turning them back into their original selves.
The imagery of the aftermath here is just incredibly moving.
It really is. You have these exhausted, traumatized people returning to the town of Lunafell. The gates open, and there are these tearful, joyous reunions in the snow. Families who thought their loved ones were dead are holding them again.
It's so sweet. Mm. But Redemain isn't celebrating.
No, she doesn't have time. She marches right up to the stone ramparts of the town to address the soldiers of December, who are angry, highly suspicious, and ready to go march into the woods and slaughter the remaining wolves.
And she makes sure she has everyone's absolute attention, because she doesn't go up to that wall empty-handed.
No, she drops the massive, severed, bleeding head of an ancient monster right onto the stone next to her.
What a power move.
Right. She projects her voice over the crowd and reveals the real conspiracy. This immortal beast, this monster she just decapitated, orchestrated the entire conflict.
For centuries, right?
Yes. For centuries, it had been killing Fey emissaries, faking attacks on the wolf borders, specifically to keep the two sides blind with rage so they would never realize they were allies.
It's a masterful piece of political theater. She literally forces the army to look at the face of the real enemy.
But here is the piece of the puzzle I really need you to explain. Why play this incredibly slow game of geopolitical chess? If this monster is so ancient and powerful, why wait generations? Why not just attack the Winter Court directly?
Well, it comes down to the mechanics of magic and law in Mirari. The monster understood the power of the oath.
The oath.
Yeah. You see, when the first Lord of December married that wolf woman, he swore a sacred magical oath to protect the wolves. In this world, a magical oath isn't just a promise. It is structural engineering.
Oh, wow.
The magical ley lines of the Winter Court, the very legitimacy of House December, are all tied directly to that ancient vow.
Oh, I see where this is going.
The monster knew it wasn't strong enough to defeat the Fey army from the outside. But if it could manipulate the current Lord December into sending his own army to wipe out the wolves,
then the Fey would unknowingly break their own founding oath.
Exactly. The sacred oath would shatter. The magical and political backlash would cause House December to completely collapse in on itself. The monster essentially weaponized their own forgotten history against them.
It used their historical amnesia to make them destroy themselves. That is a brilliantly twisted strategy.
It really is.
If you don't know your history, you can be tricked into destroying your own foundation. And yet, after all of this heavy, geopolitical, magical warfare, after the bone-snapping transformations and ancient conspiracies, the Chronicles end on this incredibly warm, deeply human note of comedic relief.
Which is honestly a necessary exhale after so much tension.
It really is. Mm-hmm. You have Thomas, the great Lord Explorer who has survived freezing lakes and wolf collars, finally getting to take a hot bath.
He earned it.
He's sitting there cracking jokes. And Redemain decides to introduce him to her mount, Rhiannon. But Rhiannon is not a normal horse. She is a terrifying Fomorian blood mare.
Oh, yeah?
She has canine teeth, she is massive, and she absolutely hates men, and she purposefully stomps right on Thomas's foot.
Such a funny moment.
It just brings this giant, clumsy warmth to the end of a very chilling tale.
It's a great reminder that even after uncovering grand conspiracies, dismantling toxic hierarchies, and surviving brutal transformations, life goes on with all of its mundane, humorous, irritating quirks.
Yeah, you still have to deal with a grumpy horse.
Exactly.
So let's trace the arc of this incredible journey one last time. We followed Knight Redmayne and Thomas from a terrifying mystery of surgical disappearances in the frozen snow. We watch Redmayne use the physical truth of the world to cut through magical illusions.
And we witnessed the horrifying mechanics of forced evolution through those iron collars.
Yeah, and the staggering power of Thomas's nonviolent resistance. We saw Redmayne endure the absolute physical agony of becoming an Omega to dismantle a culture from the bottom up.
They uncovered a forgotten alliance painted in glowing moss, and ultimately they defeated an ancient manipulator who was using their erased history as a weapon.
It's an epic story.
It is. And if we pull this out of the lands of Mirari and bring it right back to you, listening to this right now, the sociological takeaway is so vital.
How so?
Well, we live in a world that is completely overflowing with information, and yet we so often suffer from our own distinct versions of historical amnesia. We get trapped in our echo chambers. We lose the context of how our institutions were built.
We really do.
And when we strip away that context, when we isolate ourselves, when we view the other strictly as an inherently evil enemy that must be destroyed, we are doing exactly what the true monsters want us to do. We are basically pulling on a rope in the dark, exhausting ourselves against an illusion.
So think about a deep-seated conflict in your own life right now, or a bitter division you see in the world today. If you could turn the lights on, if you could peel back the generations of anger and look at the original mural on the cave wall, what forgotten alliance might you find? Are you really fighting your enemy, or are you just playing into the hands of a monster that wants you both to forget who you really are?
Incredibly powerful question to leave off on. Knowledge is only truly valuable if we use it to remember our shared humanity.
Until next time, keep looking for the murals.